Well, I'm told that all's sounding fine with you out there in TNS land, although I'm not getting a lot of feedback from Megair here, so it's on with the show. This week, Dr. Rock has travelled across the icy wastes into North Wales to speak with Ian, who's one of the moving spirits behind the Gwynedd Cannabis Club, which was an idea that I couldn't resist exploring a little bit further. Thanks a lot for joining us on TNS, Ian.
Thank you very much, Nick, and thanks for having me on. It's very difficult to get any information out about cannabis, so it's much appreciated, mate. Thanks.
I'm really, really looking forward to the conversation, I must admit. I know we've got a lot of ground to cover. Obviously, questions and comments welcome as ever in the chat box that's at tnsradio.com and at scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. We'll be doing our best to keep an eye on what's going on in there. Later on in the show, perhaps there'll be a chance to call in and join the conversation and pose some questions in person. But in the meantime, although I've clearly heard about cannabis, I'd never heard of a cannabis club before, Ian. So first off, what's one of them then?
Right, well, a Welsh or a UK cannabis club at this moment represents the voice of the cannabis user and the right to consume cannabis, basically, be it medicinally, socially, spiritually, and hopefully without interference from the law. So the cannabis clubs are aiming to promote an end to prohibition, to promote as a matter of urgency and compassion the recognition of its medicinal value, the harm reduction, to introduce a system of regulation for the production and supply of cannabis based on facts and evidence. We actually describe this in detail on the Gwynedd Cannabis Club page on Facebook and all the UK official cannabis club pages. These are all in accordance with NCOD, NCOD I'll go into about later. We also aim to encourage the production and use of industrial hemp and to educate and inform the public about the uses and benefits of cannabis. So basically anything to do with cannabis, we just want the truth to be out about it.
Brilliant. We're hoping to be playing a bit of a two-hander here. We'll be looking a little bit into the history of hemp and the history of the legislation around marijuana, as well as cannabis, as well as into some of the clinical investigations that have been made into it and some of the challenges that are arising to the legislature as a direct result of what's been discovered there. So there should be plenty of variety in that, I think. But is the cannabis club a new idea? Are they widespread around the UK?
Right, at the moment we're just growing, really. I helped operate the North Wales part of the Welsh cannabis clubs, and there are meetings every couple of months all over Wales and the UK at the moment. So this cannabis club starting up everywhere in the UK. It's worth checking Facebook and looking up your local cannabis club, because you'll probably find there is one local to you. And if there isn't, then just start one up, really. I mean, what we're there for basically is to share information. That's what's happening on the UK cannabis scene, what's happening on activism scene, sharing ideas, facts, fun info. I mean, there's new clubs coming online all the time. So, you know, try and get online and join up.
So how long's it been going on then? How long's this work been done?
Right, well, personally, I've just started up in the last few months, so I've started to go down to meetings, Welsh cannabis club meetings, where there's some excellent people like Des Humphreys, who's also a normal UK director. We've got Welsh people like Carl Scrivens, Jason Shorty, Jamie Morgan, Ruben, Brian Conlon, Terry Malaika, Kellogg's, Neil Parsons, and Jason Tafts. These are all people that are trying to get cannabis out to the people, information, so that people know the truth about cannabis. These clubs are also supported by Howard Marks. He comes and joins all the Welsh meetings. Howard Marks is Mr. Nice, if you've heard of Mr. Nice. He's actually got a few books out, and what he used to do was, back in the 60s, 70s, he used to get hold of cannabis from different countries and transport it from one country to the other, and he was quite famous for that.
Right, okay. It sounds like things have moved on quite a long way from the legalised cannabis campaign, which I was more familiar with all those years ago. It's pretty much an interesting project, given, especially, you know, given the attitudes of the establishment and the so-called courts. You presumably have got kind of a personal history and motivations for actually getting so actively involved in it, have you?
Yeah, well, cannabis makes some people happy, helps some people with stress, anxiety. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be any more dangerous than alcohol. So do we really want to go around putting people in prison and destroying their lives, stigmatizing people that choose a safer drug than alcohol and tobacco? It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I mean, I don't think that that's the solution. So what the cannabis clubs propose is a system of regulation over cannabis and to keep it in a controlled environment so that it can't be bought by children. At the moment, a teenager buys cannabis easier than alcohol. I mean, this is due to the fact that a dealer does not ask for ID. He only asks for a £20 note. So there's clearly something wrong there. So prohibition hasn't worked there. So it's a case of seeing that things aren't working the way it is, and that drugs and cannabis seem to be sort of classed as one sort of entity, when there's a lot harder drugs out there like alcohol, tobacco, cocaine. Yet it seems that cannabis is being put in the same category as these drugs, while it seems to me that scientifically the proof is there that it's a lot safer, so it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm going to hear a lot more about that as the show progresses, because there really is quite a lot of spectacular evidence that lies only in one direction, and it turns out, as we might expect, that a lot of the evidence running in the other direction has been one way or the other mishandled or misdirected. But before we get on to that, as sort of by way of introduction, and in order to explore a little bit how we got to where we are, because of course the illegality or the alleged illegality of cannabis is a fairly modern idea, perhaps we could just look a little bit into the history of it. I'll have a run through some of the stuff I know. If you want to make any extra comments, give me a nod. Because it wasn't until the 1930s that marijuana started being hunted by the, or cannabis is the preferred word, I'm told. Marijuana is the, apparently the propaganda word that was come up with, by the American government for...
Yeah, what happened was, in the Reefer Madness years, they came up with marijuana as a word that they used to sort of scare people, but, the proper name used is cannabis. So, just clear that up, yeah.
So forgive me, I habitually call it marijuana, as we're very used to playing with words on TNS and Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, so this is just another learning for the lexicon, as it were. But until the 1930s, cannabis, along with hemp, which is its industrial equivalent, was very legal indeed. Basically, hemp is cannabis without a hit to it, and it was the largest agricultural crop in the world. I'll post links to a couple of really cracking videos on this subject when I get a moment. But this is, it's genuinely a miraculous plant. It's the most robust, versatile, durable, naturally strong and soft fiber on the earth. It's also one of the longest that can be grown naturally. Up until the 1930s, most fabric, lighting oil, fiber and medicine all came from hemp. And that's not to forget paper, of course. Paper's has been one of the most important things, as we know, in spreading ideas, both good and bad, about the place. The invention of the printing press was a really grand thing. And before that, of course, we needed paper. And it turns out we are, of course, wiping out a whole load of old forest to make paper out of, and we're cutting it down fast and using it faster than we can grow it. But as it turns out, hemp turns out a particularly high-quality paper. It's the longest lasting paper that mankind's managed to make to date. And it's much more efficient in terms of material, because this old timber that we're knocking down is only 33% fiber, whereas the hemp is some 77%. So we get a lot more paper out of the hemp. It lasts longer than wood pulp paper. It's stronger. It's acid free and chlorine free. And one of the things about cannabis and hemp is that its processing requires far fewer poisons and toxins in one form or another than any other form of paper making, especially the paper making with wood. For example, chlorine's been estimated to cause up to 10% of all cancers, and is a vital element normally in the making of paper. Hemp paper can also be recycled 7 times, whereas wood pulp apparently only manages 4, so you can use it for almost twice as long. And don't forget, it lasts longer as well. Making paper from hemp uses only a fifth to maybe as little as a seventh as much polluting sulfur-based chemicals as are required, and there's no chlorine and no bleach involved. and there's 5 to 10,000 thought to be 5 to 10,000 cancer-related deaths a year caused from the use of pesticides and herbicides, and nearly half of all of the use of such pollutants in the USA is just for cotton.
Yeah, also, Nick, there is reports that on waste ground where nothing can grow, apparently if you grow hemp on it, then it will grow, and it'll actually make the soil better for future grows. So from it going from waste ground, after you've grown hemp on it, it actually sort of seasons the soil ready for another grow. Also, apparently with hemp, it has been reported on the internet on some news channels that in Chernobyl, that they actually planted hemp around Chernobyl to soak up some radiation, so that'd be worth looking into on the internet as well.
Yeah, I agree. The values of the actual plant itself are really inestimable in terms of land reclamation. I'd come across that myself. Also, it's a plant that takes very little out of the soil. If you leave it there and it allow its leaves to drop to the ground, then it stabilizes the ground because it's got a pretty intense root system, and is hugely useful for such landscaping purposes as well, of course, as being particularly beautiful, I think. In those times before government decided to turn its guns against it, hemp was being used to make over 5,000 items from the fibre alone, and as many as 25,000 from the cellulose that was remained when the fibre was removed, and that included, to my surprise, dynamite. I didn't know you could make dynamite out of cannabis. Another sort of bang entirely. Apparently in 1941, the Ford Motor Company produced an automobile with a plastic body that was made from sisal wheat and 70% hemp. Sounds more like a shredded wheat than a car. The plastic apparently withstood blows 10 times as great as steel could without even denting. Its weight was 2/3 that of a regular car, and its engine was designed to run with hemp oil fuel. Now, how about that, guys?
Yeah, there's also a video on YouTube about it, actually. James Henry Ford's hemp crop actually ran his fleet of cars, so he was actually growing the fuel to run his hemp car. So he was basically built the car and running it all from hemp. It's on YouTube. You can probably find it on there, so it's worth looking at as well.
I mean, quite apart from anything else, a motor that's 2/3 of the weight of a regular one is going to be a lot cheaper to run and a lot easier generally to move around the place. But I suppose if you found yourself stranded, unfortunately you couldn't roll it up and smoke it, but perhaps you could make one out of proper cannabis. The first marijuana law, first cannabis law, was in 1619, and it required American farmers to grow it as a crop. They were actually required to grow it. And Elizabethan England farmers were fined for not growing hemp. I love the way these things kind of flip around, the way you can get beaten for one thing one year, and then you wake up the next year and you're getting beaten for not doing it. In 1640, it was required that every citizen in Connecticut grow hemp. So they got down to the point where they were legislating so that everybody around in the state should be growing it. Apparently the war between the United States and Great Britain in 1812 was partly about access to Russian hemp, as was Napoleon's 1812 invasion of Russia, because hemp was at that stage Russia's primary trade crop. That was throughout the 18th and the 19th centuries. And from some comments we're going to be hearing from various American presidents, it was clear that they felt the same. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson grew hemp. In 1791, Jefferson said, "Hemp is the first necessity to the commerce and marine," in other words, to the wealth and protection of the country. In 1794, Washington said, "Make the most of the Indian hemp, seed and sow it everywhere." What a grand plan. They had some great ideas, didn't they? And of course, one of the reasons why the Elizabethans were being required to grow this was because we were becoming a maritime nation, and more or less everything that wasn't wood or metal tended to be made of hemp. So that included the sails, the ropes, the uniforms, the flags. I gather that they even had some kind of stab vest that was made out of some kind of punched hemp fibre. Very, very good at foiling the movement of daggers and sharp ends. The real trouble started, though, I think, and Ian's already referred to this. You might want to say a little bit about the movie, about Reefer Madness, because that was released in 1937, which, like I say, is when things started really getting hot for cannabis. It's a very funny film. I'll post some links in whilst Ian gives you a quick discussion of it.
Yeah, basically, Reefer Madness was just propaganda against cannabis to get the American public to view cannabis as a very dangerous drug that could make white women have sex with black men. There was all sorts of rubbish that they came out with, said that it caused people to go crazy and kill people. Reefer Madness is actually used now in the cannabis community to show people how far we've come from then, because people have realized that it was a load of rubbish and it was all propaganda. So yeah, it is very funny, yeah. We get the same sort of propaganda now on television here in the UK. I mean, people say to me, oh, you don't hear anything about cannabis on telly in the UK, but you've only got to watch Jeremy Kyle, you know. And usually the stem of all problems for he'll put on people is the fact that they use cannabis. Not that they drink alcohol, not that they're spending all their money on alcohol, it's just the fact that they're smoking weed, apparently, and it makes them lazy and unmotivated, which, you know, is just more propaganda to keep the public thinking the same, Reefer Madness.
So I thought that was a particularly good bit in The Union, which is one of the films I watched for this, The Business Behind Getting High. There was a comedian on there who said about the demotivation. He basically said, bullshit! And he didn't really get around to smoking it until about 5 years ago because he believed the propaganda. But I would imagine personally, as a comedian or a stage performer of any sort, it's pretty helpful. Reefer Madness is well worth a look. You can find it easy enough on YouTube. It was originally released as Tell Your Children and sometimes titled as The Burning Question, Dope Addict, Doped Youth and Love Madness as well. A 1936 American propaganda exploitation film revolving around the melodramatic effects that ensue when high school students are lured by pushers to try marijuana. From a hit-and-run accident to manslaughter, suicide, attempted rape, and descent into madness. That's a summary from Wikipedia. It's a pretty good one. I also recommend watching the black and white one first and then watching the one that's been recolored, because there is one out there that's got different colored smoke coming out of the people's mouths depending on the kind of levels of addiction and madness that they're supposed to be putting out. It's, must have worked really well as propaganda though, I suppose, you know, first time out.
Yeah, well, it did work, obviously, because for a while, cannabis use did actually go down, but after people started realizing that it was just madness, cannabis use has just constantly gone up every year, year by year by year. That's why it doesn't make sense now with the laws, really. It's just it doesn't make sense that you've got a safer drug that people want to use, but the government are refusing to allow that. But yet they're allowing alcohol, which is a more dangerous drug. So, just politically and morally, it just doesn't make sense.
It only makes sense if we suspect that there are, of course, some other political and moral imperatives in place, which we will probably end up exploring. Reefer Madness effectively was used to demonize cannabis as the cause of all manner of social ills. As Ian said, it was said to be causing women to have sex with black men, and it was making black men play the devil's music. There's a fantastic bit of film in one of the movies where you see a person of colour stepping aside to avoid treading on a white person's shadow, which, although I'd heard of it before, it's quite a visceral moment to see it actually happening and imagine a world in which that can be kind of regarded as in any way justifiable. But this was really seriously the beginning of a huge propaganda campaign, one that is clearly much more to do, has much more intent behind it than simply getting rid of something that tends to make people a bit slow moving. And this campaign, which was designed to take down the intoxicating version, was also designed, and I'm sure not by accident, to take down the harmless and extremely useful hemp. And so it was only a year after the release of Reefer Madness and just before the massive demand for oil and stuff that was going to be generated by the First World War that the US government introduced marijuana tax stamps. I'll paste a link for this in as well once I can get at it, but this is really amazing because the effect of what it says, states that the Act effectively ended hemp production in the USA, except for a brief revival, mostly for textiles and rope during the Second World War. And the way they did that was because they introduced the tax stamps and then locked them all in a vault so that nobody could use them. So basically, you needed a tax stamp to put on your hemp product, and there were no stamps available, so nobody grew hemp. This is a really pretty amazing and extant example of how simply we are guided into what we grow and what we don't grow. You can see even now, just by the numbers of poor, helpless sheep all over the fields of Wales, that the same thing's happening nowadays. But even more bizarre than that, even more bizarre than coming up with a tax act and then not providing the stamps to actually call the tax in, is that these marijuana tax stamps are still about. And again, I'll put the link in a minute. It says that at normal.org, which is one of the websites you referred to, isn't it? Who are they? Can you?
Yeah, Normal UK are a part of normal.org. Yeah, they're an organisation that started up in America, basically advocating cannabis and showing the medicinal use of it. And they've got a lot of members. They've got thousands of members, and they're doing an excellent job in America and getting through the the county laws, the sort of they've got state laws. That's it. Yeah, they've pushed the state laws, and they're getting them sort of passed down, decriminalising cannabis, getting them used for medicinal cannabis. And they've started a group up now in the UK, Normal UK, so they're sort of doing the same thing as the UK Cannabis Club, pushing the cannabis scene in the UK.
Yeah, I've just posted a link to the marijuana tax stamp laws and penalties, and that comes from normal.org's website, which is incredibly informative. I shall be going back there when I've got a little bit more time. Sven's just put into the TNS chat box that Normal have been going for years. Is nonetheless a fresh and refreshing experience for me. I must admit, I found it extremely clear, easy to find my way around, and full of extremely useful and entertaining information, including this bit about the tax stamps. It says, nowadays, in 20 US states, those who possess cannabis or other illegal drugs are legally required to purchase and affix state-issued stamps onto his or her contraband. The total cost of the tax is generally determined by the quantity of contraband possessed. So they're saying it's illegal and you've got to put a stamp on it to pay tax. Unlike typical criminal statutes, note, prohibiting the possession and sale of controlled substances, drug tax stamp laws primarily assess financial penalties on the defendant for non-compliance, and on occasion criminal sanctions may also be imposed. Which is implying that those other sanctions aren't criminal. Still, we'll pass that by. Although nearly half of all US states have marijuana tax stamp laws on the books, few citizens observe them. Most individuals are unaware that such laws exist in their state. Others fear that complying with it will incriminate their behaviour, and who can blame them? I mean, it sounds like it's bound to. Because of this widespread non-compliance, drug tax stamps, unlike so-called sin taxes on alcohol and tobacco, these do not collect tax revenue at the customer's point of purchase. Rather, the legislative intent of drug tax laws is to impose an additional penalty, tax evasion, upon drug offenders after they are arrested and criminally charged with a drug violation. Well, that is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? Fancy voluntarily putting a stamp on something and getting done for tax evasion. So getting, admitted to whatever it is you're doing, or getting done for tax evasion for not putting it on. Absolutely bizarre.
I know, it's just crazy. And now in America, what they're doing through state law, these medical dispensaries, they're actually handing out cannabis where they're getting paid for it. And then, it's still against the law for the international government, yet for some reason they're taking the tax money. So the national government in America are taking the tax money from the medical dispensaries, yet they're still criminalizing them. So they're willing to take the money, yet if they're not happy about something, they can just bust in your door and take everything and basically prosecute you and put you in jail. So
cutting both ends of the cake there. Sounds like not letting us even getting a bite in. apparently the first conviction for the possession of marijuana was the possession of 2 marijuana cigarettes, as they are known, spliffies, cannabis joints. And the poor guy went down for 4 years in jail for the possession of a couple of... That's reefer madness. World War II, hemp became momentarily popular again. I think, obviously, because it is such an easy thing to grow, and maybe they hadn't quite got the oil industries into the position where they could quite do all of the work. But one way or the other, they mostly used it, I gather, for fabrics rather than fuel. Fabrics rather than fuel, that's it. A film was made, also worth a bit of a hack, because it's always good to see another little bit of propaganda. Actually, if nothing else, I find these propaganda films a little bit more entertaining now that we know more about the illusion that is being perpetrated upon us, because it's a chance to, you tend to see a few more of the techniques that are being used. But this one was called Hemp for Victory and was released in 43, and it details, like some of the other links I've put in, many of the industrial uses of hemp, including cloth and cordage, but it also gives quite a detailed history of the plant's use.
Yeah, there was also a book written by Jack Herer, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. What he said was that hemp was the solution to everything. He said that it was a solution to energy, deforestation, global warming, biomass so that you could run cars, power stations. And he even, in his book, at the end, put a $50,000 reward for anyone that could prove him wrong. So... Well, have a look. I do a search on the internet, because from what I've seen, that money hasn't been paid out, so I can't see anyone's come up with a better idea.
Excellent. I see Aaron's just pasted up the Facebook pages for the Gwyneth Cannabis Club. Thanks a lot for doing that, Aaron. Very helpful. During the modern period, obviously, it's a bit strange that all of this should just come about. I think that that is quite clear that one of the main aims of all of this legislation is to get rid of all of the many products we can get from hemp that are and replace them with oil-based products. That seems to be a fairly major aim of the whole thing, because if nothing else, we know that's a situation that's been maintained in as many ways as possible by preventing us from getting at free energy devices that we know are out there, preventing us from using energy sources that we can see are being used for all manner of incredible purposes, but not being used by us. So it's part, I'm pretty sure, of the same agenda. But the medical criminal, or the criminalisation of the medical cannabis, the one that actually makes us feel happy and relaxed, also seems to have alternative agendas behind it. And this one really didn't take off till 1971. With yours and my favourite, I'm sure, President Nixon, who stated, when he wasn't aware that he was on the record, in all fairness, but he stated that every one of the bastards that are out for legalising marijuana is Jewish. Well, I was pretty surprised by that one. That was a new one on me, but I really would suppose I ought to have a listen to look at those White House tapes at some point if they're full of things like that. But obviously Nixon had it in for them, and in 1972... he basically started what was going to be the war on cannabis proper. He, as far as I can gather, kicked off by a lot of information that was actually in the historical record round and about in various bits of American government, was at that stage destroyed, removed, or lost, which is another standard technique of the world management team when they want to rewrite things. And he commissioned a thing called the Schaefer Report, which stated, like all of the others before it, without exception, that cannabis is basically harmless and that no criminal sanction could possibly be recommended for its use or possession. The response to this was, as with so many reports and inquiries, to screw it up and file it in the big green filing cabinet where nobody was ever going to see it again. So getting rid of the Schaefer report was one thing that was done. What was done on the ground was that apparently 76 New Jersey troopers were made into detectives. Half of them were put undercover. And their job was basically to target pot smokers. And of course, there was probably an alternative agenda here as well, in that at that stage in the game, most of the people who were smoking pot were also protesting against the Vietnam War. And so it's quite clear if you can manage to round up and harass the pot smokers, you will be rounding up and harassing most of the people who are protesting against something that you'd rather people didn't protest against. Also, at this stage, really, whereas the first point, after Reefer Madness, cannabis had been made illegal because it was depraving people and making them do all sorts of devilish things that they wouldn't otherwise do. Effectively, what was happening now is that cannabis was being criminalised for making people peaceful and poorly motivated.
Yeah, what also happened then as well was because they concentrated on cannabis, it was a reason to stop black American youth, and basically in America now you've got a prison system that is full of black young people who smoke cannabis. They're basically stigmatized for smoking cannabis, and they end up in jail. I think in America they've got a three hits and you're out rule. So basically, if you get caught with maybe just a couple of grams of cannabis three times, then you go into jail, and there's no sort of pleading out of that one. So and then the sort of corporatized prison system in America, where they've got thousands of these young black American poor people. They're actually working in these jails as well, and you know they're not getting paid a wage. Obviously, the prison system is a corporatization, and they're there to make money. So they're obviously making money some way, and that could be a way that they're making a lot of money.
They most certainly are making a lot of money. Last time I saw, the American penal system represents a whole third of their gross domestic product, because they're making lots of their military gear there. It's illegal to import slave produced goods into America because it's basically competition for the in-house slaves that are working in the prison system. Aaron Jones has put in another good fact about cannabis, is that cannabinoids found in cannabis are also found in the breast milk given to babies from their mums. Another good reason for not using formula milk, eh?
Yeah, believe it or not, in the last 20 or something odd years, they've actually realised that there's an endocannabinoid system that is part of the human body, and it actually self-regulates and controls things like mood, appetite, your system that fights diseases and germs. It actually sort of has a control over all those type of things. So scientists at the moment are just sort of delving into that and realizing the benefits of what cannabis can do, because apparently with this endocannabinoid system, the only thing out there that can sort of regulate this system is cannabis. So basically what they're saying is that cannabis is actually goes along with the human body and is actually part of something that sort of works with the human body.
Which is presumably why we found evidence of it at human camps ever since the old Stone Age. And this internal system is part of the endocrine system, which is what determines whether we feel frightened, happy, sad, all the rest of it. The release of all of these hormones through our own internal systems does in fact conduct a manner of dance with the cannabis as it enters the system. It seems to be very much a cooperative system. There's a lot of receptors for CBDs and THCs in the human system. And those receptors do basically fund energetically the energy systems in the human body, these seven endocrine organs that sit behind our chakras. Tim from Tang has put in that they're scared shitless of peaceful folk because you can't control them, which I think is a fair point. And Sven's put in, it wouldn't surprise me if part of the reason for banning it was to encourage people to smoke it. And Tim's put, I would suggest a profit motive more likely. The two things go pretty much together, though, don't they, really?
Well, I mean, you've got governments in America and governments in the UK that claim that there's no medicinal benefits off cannabis, yet we've got an endocannabinoid system which only works off cannabis, which helps regulate, you know, things in your body, and you've got receptors for cannabis. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It seems as if they want to tell lies to the public so that we don't smoke cannabis, yet behind the scenes, they're actually funding drug agencies, pharmaceutical companies, to produce cannabis-based medicine, and yet it is still a Schedule 1 drug, which means that it has no medicinal value. So someone's telling lies somewhere, and someone's making a lot of money somewhere.
Or both, of course. And it is the It's not just that the evidence for clinical benefit is being hidden. There's also been a bit of a campaign in the past, as in a lot of branches of science, we must disappointingly announce, that have directly endeavoured to prove the contrary. One of the most famous is the 1974 Heath Tulane study. And this study, here we go, I'm afraid that animals are damaged in the execution of this particular study. The scientists concerned claimed to have administered 30 Colombian strength marijuana cigarettes per day for 1 year to a bunch of monkeys. Or lucky monkeys, we might think. They further claimed that the results showed that the brain cells of the monkeys were damaged by this process, i.e. by smoking 30 Colombian strength marijuana cigarettes a day, every day for 1 year. It was this report, in fact, the Heath Tulane study, that was later referenced by Ronald Reagan when he said permanent brain damage is one of the inevitable results of the use of marijuana. And you can imagine how far that phrase travelled. In fact, after quite a lot of pressure and quite a lot of time as well, the experimenters were forced to admit that rather than administering the 30 a day for a year, they were in fact administering once a day the equivalent of 63 Colombian spliffs daily, and they were delivering this in 5 minutes through a gas mask and providing no additional oxygen to the monkeys. And we know that after 4 minutes without oxygen, brain cells begin to die. So it was eventually concluded that it was quite possibly suffocation that was doing for the monkeys' brains and probably not the cannabis, especially given the complete failure up to that date or since to provide any such real evidence. In fact, in 2005, I gather a research paper suggested that marijuana may actually stimulate the growth of brain cells, although I haven't actually been able to track that one down. Reagan also stated that he was totally against the legalization of marijuana, and later George Bush Jr. said that acceptance of drug use is simply not an option for this administration. And yet, according to George's much-resisted unofficial biography, which I can personally highly recommend, it's called Fortunate Son. The American government tried very, very hard to stop it being published. It was, I think, 2 or 3 years in the courts before it was finally allowed out, and it was released in a special expanded version, Fortunate Son. The main text, I think, is about 140 pages long and is really pretty horrifying in itself. But it's got notes at the back which cover maybe twice as much text and tell you who got what and from whom. But according to that, our friend Georgie the Bush was one time an alcoholic and a cocaine user. So perhaps he's mended his ways, eh? And really, a standard administrative conditioning technique has been employed ever since. Really, much fear has been created with regard to the use of cannabis and what cannabis users and dope fiends might do. And then much money has been created and spent to counter the fear that's been generated. So I'm going to play a quick tune now, give you a bit of a rest, and we'll move on to things like the idea of we'll start looking into how much relative harm cannabis might do and how it is that people get into it, and a little bit more about the medicines and things. So we'll be back with you in, I should think, 3 or 4 minutes, and... Welcome back. You're listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Tonight, seeking solutions through cannabis. And I've heard a little bit about the history of it, and there really is lots. It's really a massive story that we've just skated over there. But I wanted to get on to some of the questions that are really addressed a little bit more satisfactorily nowadays by the mainstream media than they used to be. And of course, one of the first things that comes up when we're talking about any kind of controlled drug, such as they're called, is concern about the relative harm between various legal and illegal highs. Now, of course, we're always talking about heroin and cocaine and cannabis and amphetamines and all of that. And alcohol. We don't so often talk about things like sugar and coffee, although they are considered in a lot of modern studies. As things stand, the official main killer in America at the moment is apparently tobacco, with an estimated 430,000 deaths a year. unlike hemp, tobacco is a government subsidized crop and it is grown using radioactive fertilizer, which is sprayed from the air. That is why your cigarettes are and tobacco is radioactive. And of course, it can't be doing a lot of good to anybody who's around that kind of activity, quite apart from the people who actually choose to buy and smoke the cigarettes. It's reckoned that ignoring deaths from poor diet and lack of exercise, which is another interesting point, I suppose they're difficult to count. Alcohol comes in after tobacco, killing an estimated 85,000 people a year. Caffeine between 1,000 and 10,000, which is quite a widespread. And aspirin, the innocent aspirin, apparently killing 7,500 people a year. I also found out whilst I was looking into this particular subject that it's not widely known that aspirin's tendency to cause internal bleeding is apparently enhanced when it's taken with alcohol. And of course, the point here is that marijuana has not been shown to be the sole cause of death in anyone, anywhere. And I've seen it said again and again, I've seen it in some of the reports and studies, that it is, to all intents and purposes, impossible to take too much. Hey, let's skip up another eight. You want to go?
Yeah, also on the 27th of July this year, well, 2012, sorry, the British Medical Journal published an extensive study. What they did was they called the paper "The Quantifying Harms to Self and Others from Substance Misuse," resulted from a survey of clinical experts across Scotland. Basically, it was a collective of six research bodies, five from the UK and one from our Commonwealth cousins in New Zealand, who also operate under a policy of prohibition like ours. And the study was carried out by 292 clinical experts. The aim of the study was to produce a consensus hierarchy of harm to self and others from legal and illegal substances used. It is similar to what we've seen and heard before from Dr. David Nutt, which we'll talk about in a minute. And after doing this research and the science, the results were that there was no stepped categorical distinction in harm between the different legal and illegal substances. So basically, some illegal substances were less harmful than some that were legal. They also concluded that heroin was viewed as the most harmful, which would obviously make sense, but might be a bit of a shock here for some people, and that cannabis was viewed as the least harmful of all substances studied. So alcohol was ranked as the fourth most harmful substance, with alcohol, nicotine and volatile solvents being viewed as more harmful than some Class A drugs. So it seems to me that the government's drug, the way that they've put the drug laws out, it just doesn't correspond with the harms of drugs. So something's wrong with the laws on drugs in this country.
And that, of course, is not even to start talking about the psychiatric drugs that, quite frankly, ruin the lives of even the straightest and most competent and most professional of people, some of whom, in the interests of investigation, have tried them out and found their lives ruined in a very short space of time, even though they were taking minuscule doses of the drugs that they had previously been prescribing in quantity to others.
Yeah, that's also true with child drugs that they're giving out, because also in this report, it says that cannabis is the least harmful drug out of the 19 legally available over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs and recreational drugs. So basically it's saying there that cannabis was less harmful than most prescription drugs. It said that cannabis is safer than even a drug given to children at an alarmingly high rate called the Ritalin. So basically they're saying that cannabis is less harmful than some of these prescription drugs that they're giving to children as well.
I'd say that's certainly the case. If Ritalin is anything what I've heard it to describe to be, it is certainly considerably more distracting than marijuana. Also, I'd just like to add a bit of a rider to all of those statistics on deaths by various means in the United States of America, because, of course, we are starting to see more and more that iatrogenesis is taking over. Possibly, I think I heard that doctor or physician inspired death, basically through error or misdiagnosis or malprescription or use of over-the-counter medicines, prescribed medicines or whatever, is now killing more people in the United States than cancer and heart disease put together. So none of these statistics can be taken as absolute truths, because it all depends on the databases that are being used and who it is that's doing the looking.
Also with for instance, you can just sort of make out, you could point out that cigarettes are legal and cannabis isn't. So basically you can get done for having a safer drug in your pocket, because if you had a cigarette in your pocket, nobody would blink twice. But if you've got a bit of cannabis, which is a safer drug that is not, that's not going to kill you, it's actually got medicinal benefits, you're going to get done for it.
And it is true as well. It seems to be pretty much well documented that the actual smoking of pure cannabis without the tobacco in it does not cause lung cancer and does not cause any other problems to arise. It also should be said, quite possibly, that properly grown tobacco, it's probably true of that as well. The problem we have specifically with our cigarettes is the buggers that are making them and selling them to us. During the modern period of reports and investigations, and there have been many, there's a lot of interest in this subject, almost all documents filed encourage no criminal penalty. In fact, I think we can safely say that all documents filed encourage no criminal penalty if they've come from advisory groups. It's only when they get into the hand of the men in suits behind the cabinet table that they get, as we have seen before on the show, slightly disarranged. But this is, you know, the other thing I'd like to say is that in any event, using the criminal law to legislate for health is clearly not a helpful idea. And I'd also like to put in a little punt for magic mushrooms, because they came out as just marginally less safe than cannabis, right down there at the bottom of the list. I think they were second from bottom. So cannabis and magic mushrooms, they're both being victimized. What about addiction? We're told that there are more American teenagers in treatment for marijuana than for all the other drugs combined, which is a pretty miraculous thing, I reckon. And this is apparently coming about because many, many people, I think 750,000 a year in America, are being arrested for possession. They're being taken to court, and in the court, well, obviously, an alleged court, and they're being offered either a substantial penalty or treatment. That is the offer that's put open to them, and most of them evidently choose treatment rather than time behind bars. And it seems to be that this is the way through which some 3% of teenagers actually choose to enter treatment. The other 87% are being coerced.
Yeah, I'm looking at this, and something seems wrong here, because from what I'm reading and the new science that's coming out regarding addiction and cannabis, is that believe it or not, cannabis being a fairly safe substance, they're actually saying that cannabis can actually help people get off harder drugs. I mean, I know this isn't new, sort of out there as big news to everyone, but the science is saying that cannabis can be used to sort of wean people off harder drugs. And believe it or not, the California Society of Addiction Medicine is also advocating this. Also, we've got the DEA in America, who are the Drug Enforcement Agency. They've actually been questioned about using cannabis as an addictive medicine to get people off addictive drugs. And the DEA, the person who was representing the DEA, she was sweating in the court. That's also on YouTube, so if you want to look that up, it's DEA cannabis questioning or something like that. You probably find it on YouTube, but I mean, there's amazing information in there, and the guy that's questioning really sort of takes her to town on cannabis and the other drugs and the addictive qualities of drugs compared to cannabis, which, you know, cannabis hasn't got much addictive quality, so it's a fairly sort of safe drug to use.
Yeah. Freeman Jack's put in the chat box at TNS, it's been found now that the weed in a joint appears to ameliorate the harm done by the cigarette.
Yeah, well, what they reckon, the science says apparently, that if you mix skunk with tobacco, that the usual sort of cancerogenic effects you get off the tobacco, the cannabis actually protects you from those, because cannabis is an anti-carcinogenic agent, so it's actually a substance, I mean, so it's actually protecting you from the tobacco. But my advice obviously would be not to mix it with tobacco.
Spoils the hit, quite apart from anything else. I find I like to keep them separate myself. Sven's put in that it's usually the police representatives that vote against any changes in drug class and the government in the government studies. That's absolutely true as well, Sven. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. And what are they doing? They are the people that who are supposed to be supporting and implementing whatever it is that's put in place. They're not supposed to be the ones who are lobbying one way or the other, because surely that represents some sort of conflict of interest. As Freeman Jack says, Freeman Jack, proving smoking dope don't make you stupid. Love the man. And as you say, withdrawal of marijuana has not been demonstrated to result in any of the physical or nervous systems that arise when alcohol or tobacco consumption is interrupted. In this sense, marijuana is not demonstrably a physically addictive substance. Nick Nomics in there agreeing with the guest, and Dr. Rock, smoke a pipe or bake some brownies. Or both.
Yeah, also I'll just make a quick point, and we'll get in the medicinal use in here as well, because most of the time when you have these debates, nobody ever brings up the fact that cannabis has major medicinal uses. It's never brought up in the debates. But because what they say is that there's no scientific evidence for it. But obviously if you're going to wait, if a drug is illegal for a start, you're not going to be able to sort of do tests on it, because if you did test on an illegal drug, you're going to get done for it, obviously. So this is something that Dr. David Nutt is sort of pushed for, is to say that if we can decriminalize some of these drugs, then we can actually look into them as look into their therapeutic uses as well as medicinal uses. I mean, we've got people on the internet, you've got groups, you've got thousands of people in these groups on the internet that claim that medical marijuana helps glaucoma, cancer, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, AIDS, arthritis, chronic pain, menstrual cramps, and you know, alcohol and opiate addiction, like I was saying earlier, depression, debilitating mood disorders, arthritis, migraines. It's just a lengthy list. And yet, for some reason, the governments tell us that there's no medicinal value there. Yet all these people, thousands upon thousands, and if you look all around the world, it's hundreds of thousands, if not up to millions of people that are using cannabis medicinally, and they're being told that there is no medicinal value in it. It's just a ridiculous situation.
Several years ago now, I saw that well and truly demonstrated on mainstream TV. It was presumably Channel 4, though I can't honestly remember. And it was a show about four people, all of whom had physically very, very debilitating illnesses. The two I remember, one was an old lady who was sitting in her chair, and she deliberately not smoked for 48 hours for the purposes of the show. And she was all curled up like people with arthritis are, so her hands looked like claws, and she looked really small curled up in the chair. And her son was rolling little single skin cannabis cigarettes for her, and she saw her smoke one of these things, and she just unfurled like a flower. It was amazing. All of her pain went away, and she looked to all intents and purposes then like a normal old lady in a chair. One cigarette, and similarly, it was only 48 hours without that had done that for her.
Yeah, there's also a story, there's actually a page on Facebook, and it's going on in America now. It's been on Weed Wars, which was a series on Discovery Channel, I think it was, regarding Jaden. He's got Dravet syndrome. He's a young lad, only about 6-7 years old, and his father, who's very religious, after trying hundreds of different mixtures, cocktails of drugs, he decided eventually to give cannabis a go, and believe it or not, it's the only thing that has worked for this little lad to have a seizure-free day. And it's quite emotional when you read it. You can find all about that on YouTube, and on if you look through Facebook, Jaden Dravet syndrome. If you put that into Google, you probably come up with it. It's quite famous in America. He's on all the news channels trying to push the fact that his son is getting benefits from cannabis. And the fact that, you know, he's actually had his son back, because when his son was having these fits, every day he was having like 2, 3, 4 fits a day, and he was having trouble to sort of get through to him. Now he's having seizure-free days where he can actually sort of get through to his son. So that's quite emotional, and it's quite nice to see that these stories are getting out there now.
And that's an absolute demonstration, if we need one, that it is the human endocrine system that's being acted on here. The fact that you can have that kind of fundamental effect by imbibing this stuff shows, in my mind anyway, that the energy systems that are so vital to the human entity are what's being affected. We're affecting very much, if you like, the hormonal and energetic level of the body as much as the physical level. So it seems to be getting to the roots of the problem rather than simply addressing symptoms. So what about the gateway theory? What do you make of this idea that because people are smoking marijuana, they end up taking crack?
Yeah. Well, I've never taken it, so... Right. Well, I was brought up in a pub, look, so from the age of about 12 to 20, all I got was alcohol and cigarette smoke, and that was my environment. So I was probably sort of slowly dying in that environment. So I sort of society would probably call it rebelling by the fact that I'm smoking cannabis, but I would call it making a sort of better choice. So I just smoke cannabis instead of drinking alcohol, smoking tobacco. None of those sort of appeal to me. But as a gateway drug, due to the fact that I don't drink alcohol, I don't smoke cigarettes, I don't take any sort of other drugs at all, zero, not even prescription drugs. So it's not been a gateway drug for me. There's also the fact that I think most people probably start off on drug-wise either on prescription drugs or on alcohol. Yeah. So I'd probably say and tobacco. So if we're talking about gateway drugs, then you've probably got them there.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point, well made. We've got just a quick reference in here from SS in the TNS chat room about Rick Simpson's Run from the Cure. Do you want to say a bit about Rick, or...?
Well, I've watched the video. He's obviously making an oil that they reckon is anti-cancerous, anti-tumorous, so that it can actually get rid of... cancerous tumours, and there is evidence showing that there is anti-tumorous effects, and the clinical studies have been done on rats, I think, and it has been proven. So Rick Simpson, he's doing a good job. Obviously, he's pushing it, but he's having difficulty pushing it to where it needs to be, obviously, because he's getting stopped, and you know, people are putting him down, saying it's a load of rubbish, and this is how it goes, isn't it? This is how they work. They put you down so that you can't get your information out, but the information he's putting out, I mean, it's fantastic. It's proper scientific information by the looks of it.
Yeah. That, of course, if you want to see more about that, Run from the Cure is the name of the vid, available on DVD or on YouTube. Also, of course, Scottish Sovereign's on the land, and TNS is podcasts include, to my knowledge, at least two, maybe three interviews with Rick Simpson and with some of the people that have been benefited by this process. And I know that people actually on these sites have had results using it, both with humans and with their pets, because of course these things work just as well on dogs and horses as they do on humans, which is another thing which tends, in my opinion, to validate what it is that's going on.
With the oil also, this cannabis oil, it's worth just mentioning that GW Pharmaceuticals have got a medicine out called Sativex. Basically, our government have handed a unique monopoly license to GW Pharmaceuticals to grow tons of high-potency cannabis that have been bought by donations. So basically, GW Pharmaceuticals have been paid a load of money by the government and given a license so that they can grow cannabis, even though it's a Schedule 1 illegal drug. So basically, it's a deception to distinguish Sativex from cannabis, when in fact it is cannabis. It's just two strains of cannabis mixed together and tinctured down to an oil to make Sativex. It's not, obviously, cannabis being a Schedule 1 controlled drug, it's supposed to have no medicinal value. But for some reason, Sativex under GW Pharmaceuticals is actually getting prescribed out as a medicine, when apparently we have no medicinal value in cannabis. So there's obviously a monopoly and a deception going on there. The Home Office has actually issued an open general license for this product. So it means that they're removing the legal requirement for doctors, pharmacists and patients to apply for individual licenses with the Home Office in order to be prescribed Sativex. So to be legally validly prescribed sativex, you must have a written prescription, and this written prescription will be exempt from record keeping in the NHS. So basically what they're saying is, we're handing this drug out as a medicine when it's not supposed to be a medicine under law. But not only that, we're giving the prescriptions out, but we're not actually keeping a record of it, so nobody can see or nobody can actually check who's getting this medicine and if it works or whatever. So there's no record keeping allowed, and this is what our government have done. This is what the Home Office have let the sort of pharmaceutical agencies get away with. And this sativex, just to finish it off, because it does get slightly worse, sativex, the basic price of a 310 milliliter pack is £400 from what I've researched on the internet. £400 for a 330 mil of oil. So,
you get yourself beaten up for
and apparently this 3x10 milliliter pack only lasts for something like 3 to 4 days. So, that's costing a lot of money for anyone who wants that medicine. So, obviously someone is making a lot of money by making that medicine as well.
I posted a link to the UK CIA news blog, news and comment about cannabis law reform. And, it's an article called Sativex, Still a Forbidden Medicine. I'm just going to read a bit of it out for those people who don't have access to the chat box and can't see the link. Because this is actually a bit of a crux point for the legislature, because this, in my opinion, is one of the lens places where they're really getting themselves into a bit of a bind, painted into a corner. The item says the legal situation with respect to Sativex continues to be a mess. Sativex is a cannabis medicine developed by GW Pharmaceuticals, which has been approved as a prescription medicine for the treatment of plasticity caused by multiple sclerosis. It's a subject this blog has covered before. Just to recap an important point, Sativex is cannabis. It is not a pure chemical extracted from the plant. It is all of the active ingredients obtained from the blending of two specific strains of cannabis. There's been an extraction process which has removed all of the vegetable matter, but pharmacologically, Sativex is cannabis. This is a very important point to make, because if the flowering heads from a blend of the plants used to make Sativex were rolled into a tobacco-filled joint and smoked, the same cannabis chemicals would be inhaled, albeit along with all the other stuff in the smoke from the burned vegetation and, of course, the tobacco, as Sativex delivers in its spray. The point being, the preparation and delivery method is irrelevant to the cannabis content of the drug. This is important because the Misuse of Drugs Act defines cannabis as Schedule 1, as Ian's explained, with no medicinal value. We therefore have the rather odd situation of the NHS prescribing a drug not recognised under law as having any medicinal value. It's not the first time, is it? And this is often used as an excuse to withhold Sativex by patient care trusts. Clever, eh? This has to change, and the government is fully aware of it and has been for some time. Professor Les Iverson wrote to James Brokenshire in the Home Office with an outline of the situation. It is the recommendation that cannabis-based medicines be moved to Category 2 or 4 of the Misuse of Drugs Act, which would recognise the medical applications. This has been its position since 2003, 9, 10 years ago. However, it isn't as simple as one might have liked, which is why it hasn't happened yet. Their basic problem is, and the rest of the item is well worth reading, it's not too long, but their basic problem is, how do they manufacture legislation that enables GW Pharmaceuticals to market this Sativex at the same time as maintaining, in an illegal status, the actual physical plant, which is not only exactly the same thing, but I gather there's a one-to-one relationship between CBDs and THC in there, which makes it pretty much the ideal kind of balance as well. So it's not just any kind of mix Sativex isn't, but nonetheless, you could make a mix that's exactly like it that would be just cannabis, and it's very difficult for them to make one illegal and the other one legal. So that's just one place, I think, where they're kind of, like I say, painting themselves into a corner. They fired in that article, it actually says this is one place where an unstoppable force is meeting an immovable object.
Yeah, what's happened, Nick, is the government's sort of made cannabis unlawful, and then sort of they've created prohibition, but now what they're doing is they're trying to sneak cannabis through as a government-sanctioned monopoly as a medicine. You see, that's what they're doing. You see, so that they're getting total control to deal cannabis over a counter through a chemist while it's still a Section 1 drug. So, I mean, if we're going by law, if the average guy did that, he would be classed as a criminal, as a drug dealer. He would be stigmatized, wouldn't he? He'd be a drug dealer. Yet, for some reason, the government and these businesses, the corporation and the chemists, the doctors, they all get away with it.
One might even think, might one not, Ian, that there is one law for them and another for us.
Yeah.
So, and of course, this business of not record keeping on the Sativex, that's interesting as well. One of the main defences that's coming up at the moment is not taking minutes in meetings, all manner of stuff where records are not kept, or when the records that are kept are required, they have slipped down the back of the filing cabinet or been, I don't know, lost down the lift shaft or eaten by a temp or something. The amount of times that the documentation that's needed is not there is quite amazing. And so, to a certain extent, I guess they're just systemizing what has become a bad habit. And that's not the first time we've heard that before either. Crime and violence is another thing that comes up with marijuana. Of course, they like to call it a war on drugs. They even call it, cannabis is a bit of a poster child, really, for the war on drugs in America. So the war on cannabis, war on drugs. They like to use these kind of terms. There is inevitably lots and lots of evidence that alcohol is causative of both public and domestic violence. And I know that there have been comments already in the chat box tonight about how alcohol is a problem in the home, and cannabis isn't. And there's no evidence for cannabis being in any way significant in this regard. And plenty of evidence to the contrary, actually, that, you know, you might have wanted to hit somebody 5 minutes ago, but hey, you'll forget about it pretty quickly. It's also fair to say that, as we know, it's a well-told story. Under alcohol prohibition, everything got worse. Most people were not willing to obey, and as a result, there was a marked decline in respect for the law generally, something which must to a certain extent go with this as well. There were apparently more speakeasies in Manhattan under prohibition than there are taverns and licensed premises now. That's probably more to do with the fact that they're having their arses taxed off, I would think, but it, nonetheless, it is a point worth making. And at that point, as we all know, effectively gangsters and the criminal underworld took over manufacture, distribution and the sale of the prohibited product. We'll be looking a little bit into how that works with marijuana, hopefully before the end of the show. Also, of course, cannabis is a weed. Really, you can chop bits off it and stick it in the ground and most of them will grow. It really is not fussy about where it grows. Dappled shade, full sunshine, you know, it might change its quality a little bit, but basically it is a weed. Why are we paying 200 gaming tokens for an ounce of marijuana, whereas a similar price, and maybe even less nowadays, would get you a ton of, say, corn or wheat? You know, it should be that kind of crop, not the kind of crop that we've got. Also, of course, as they increase penalties, price increases.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I read the study on the internet as well, Nick, that cannabis as a crop was the number one cash crop in America. Obviously, there's no... there might be documentation to prove that now with medicinal dispensaries sort of dealing out, but that's quite interesting, more than whey and protein, and, you know, it's the number one cash crop. Also, just going back to your crime, to the crime earlier, my sort of life has been dealing with people in care, sort of physically disabled and young people that are in care as well. And I've seen the stigmatisation that young people have had by being criminalised for smoking cannabis and put in care. I mean, if they were drinking alcohol, they wouldn't have been in care. Basically, they would have sort of not even got to the court system. They would have had a slap on the wrist and sort of sent home. But because he'd been caught with cannabis more than a few times, they decided that was reason enough for him to go to a youth unit where he was looked after and where he wasn't with his parents. And having worked in the youth system in this country, it's not the best. It's not the best at all.
And did you find that there was a significant number of these youngsters who were in there on sort of cannabis-related issues?
It's quite strange because a lot of these youngsters seem to have knowledge that exceeded those of the politicians. So they seem to understand that cannabis is quite a benevolence drug, but it's not that safe for youngsters. That's the thing. There is reports saying that for an undeveloped brain, cannabis is not something that should be used because of its sort of psychoactive ingredients. So, possibly they sort of know half truths, these youngsters, but it's only half truths they know because of the drug laws and the drug information that the government is giving out more than anything. Because they're saying that it's causing mental health problems and that it'll cause them to go crazy, and in a way you're sort of setting them up to have a smoke, and that's what they're going to feel, that's going to happen, and that's not what happens at all. And then they smoke this drug, and then they see, oh right, that's what I was told happened, it hasn't happened. So that, in a way, sort of makes them feel, well, if that isn't the truth about cannabis, I wonder what will happen if I take some cocaine or if I take some heroin. Is it not as bad as what I've been told by the government, by the laws? So the laws need to sort of fall in line with what the drug harms actually are, so that people, young people especially, when they're getting brought up, they know exactly the truth of what the harm is of each drug. Not sort of reefer madness and manipulation, because this is why we're in the state that we're in with hard drugs and people going on to harder drugs. It's because they're being, one of the reasons they're being given false information.
Yeah, and if we're given false information, what chance do we stand of making anything like a sensible decision? And I think it's a fair point as well that, yeah, it's known that young bodies, ill effects that occur to adults as a result of kind of ingestion of environmental toxins and things like that have relatively small effect because of our increased body mass and for various other reasons. I mean, the children themselves are apparently, I'm told, they're in a hypnagogic state till they're about 7 anyway, so they're kind of in a trip and not yet attached to the world. And then there's another major change when they get to be 16. The actual kind of, the more synapses and things that have been used in your brain by the time you're 16, the more will be used in your adult life. There's a kind of pruning process that goes on at that point.
Yeah. Also, the same report that said that, that sort of concluded that cannabis is not good for the undeveloped brain for youngsters. Just to mention that they also said that it would be perfect, that from the research that they'd done, that it was perfectly safe for adults to smoke cannabis, that there was no harm. So, you know, just to mention that.
So that's why it's one of the important things we possibly do need to consider is the fact that it is, as Ian pointed out earlier on, easier for, because of the prohibited nature of marijuana, of cannabis, and the legal nature of alcohol, legal but controlled nature of cigarettes and alcohol, it is actually easier for children to get hold of cannabis. Once again, we might assume that this is being done deliberately.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make sense. I've been to see my MP, Elvin Llwyd, about this, and I mean, I know there's old school people, you know, but he just couldn't seem to get his head around it. What he was trying to say was that, oh, cannabis is dangerous, so we're not going to decriminalise it. How stupid. Well, cannabis is less dangerous than tobacco and alcohol. And so if it's less dangerous for the start, why should it not be decriminalised?
And did he respond to that? I mean, it's a bang to rights argument. Everybody says that it doesn't do you any harm. Everybody says that there shouldn't be any criminal sanction. And yet he's saying, well, you know, maybe we should. You know, it is the politicians. So often they ignore the advice of their own advisory committees. And we've actually got an absolutely cracking example of that right now. We'll just play a 3.5 minute pod of Professor Nutt, who you might remember was on one of the government's committees advising them on what was safe and what wasn't. And he was forced to resign from his unpaid post as a result of what he said. And here he is on Newsnight. And frankly, I'd heard Professor Nutt's ideas before and completely behind them, but I don't know what you lot think, but I was pretty appalled by the, I don't know, well-conditioned slant that the Newsnight presenter is putting on it. And not only well-conditioned, but really, I think, quite aggressive as well. So here it is. This is Professor Nutt with two T's on Newsnight. I'll post the link into the chat box whilst it's playing.
Advisor Professor David Nutt has been sacked by the Home Secretary Alan Johnson following his criticism of the decision to reclassify cannabis from a Class A to a Class B drug. Alan Johnson said Professor Nutt's behaviour ran contrary to his responsibilities. Well, Professor Nutt joins me now. Do you think that is the reason you were sacked?
Well, it all goes back, I think, to when Gordon Brown took office. Until then, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs had made multiple recommendations over 40 years, and every one of them had been accepted by the government. And Gordon comes in and Gordon says, cannabis should be Class B, because it's a lethal drug, especially in the form of skunk. Now, that is a politician getting science very, very wrong. And from that point on, I think the relationships between my council and the government began to unravel.
But is that a question of science, or is it a question of how the criminal justice system operates? You can say X is more dangerous than Y, and so, but it's up to the politicians to decide what then to do with it. Haven't you overstepped the mark?
Well, no, the way the Misuse of Drugs Act is supposed to work is that we are supposed to estimate the harms of drugs, and we are then supposed to tell government what we think the harms are, and recommend to them where the drug should be classified in the Act. It shouldn't be the other way around. The politicians shouldn't say to us, we think cannabis is Class B or ecstasy is Class A. Go away and find the evidence to support us. That's quite wrong.
But when you say things like in the Guardian newspaper today, if you think scaring kids will stop them using, you're probably wrong. That's going way beyond your job, isn't it?
Well, my goal in life is to reduce the harms from drug use. I believe that the best way of doing that is to have a fully scientifically founded Misuse of Drugs Act, which means telling people the truth about drugs. If you pretend that you can lie to kids who know considerably more about drugs than most politicians, all you're doing is demeaning yourself and undermining any sensible message that my committee might give.
But you can be a campaigner for changing the drug laws, that's one thing. If you take the job as an independent scientific advisor to the government, aren't you necessarily constrained?
Well, the government would like to think so. I don't think so. I think independent scientific advisors should give scientific advice, and hopefully governments would take it. The advice we give, I believe, would produce the best regulation of drugs.
Do you think there will be any other sackings or resignations following yours?
Well, I hope there are no more sackings, but I would not be at all surprised if other members of my council resign. In fact, I only know one has. Because
One
has already told me he will resign, and I wouldn't be surprised if others do. I think what has happened today has actually considerably undermined the confidence of scientists in government, and really dug away at the huge amount of work. I mean, I have spent 10 years working for government in this area, unpaid, totally unpaid. So have many of my council have worked for longer, and then they see that their work is devalued by these relatively simple sort of political decisions.
Professor Nutt, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
There we go. Professor Nutt suggesting that independent scientific advisers should give independent scientific advice. That's probably quite a novel idea as far as the government's concerned, and they certainly weren't very keen on the advice that he had to give. And let's make no mistake, the vast majority of reports and inquiries that are published and are of serious interest to the population are pretty much ignored by government in exactly the same way as that one was. And, you know, the newscaster was definitely trying to put him in his place there, and he was simply trying to put across, look, like the whole idea of these independent, you know, investigatory panels is to inform, is for the people who know and understand to try and inform the people who don't know and understand so that they may govern the people fairly and in the interests of the people. And that is one very, very clear example of exactly where that didn't happen. And there turns out to be many reasons, apart from, of course, the fact that it's harmless, that Professor Nutt has got a point one of the links that that Ian sent me was to do with potential treatment for schizophrenia that's arisen as a result of some investigations into cannabis. Have you got something ready to say about that?
What it is the science coming out now apparently that CBD, which is a component in cannabis, has actually got antipsychotic effects, so it actually counteracts the THC, which is the psychoactive ingredient. So, but the problem we've got with cannabis nowadays is most of the cannabis that's grown to a high grade is high in THC but low in CBD. So with this new science coming out now, there's more seed companies now setting up companies and seeds that are supplying a 1-to-1 ratio or more close to a 1-to-1 ratio of CBD and THC. So people that do have psychotic effects, maybe the CBD could be for them. Maybe they could look into it on the internet and do some research themselves, because they're not going to find out about it unless they sort of investigate it themselves, because you're not going to get it from the local doctor down at the NHS.
And I'd recommend very much reading the link that we've just put in there, Marijuana Compound Treats Schizophrenia from healthlandtime.com, because it carries quite a lot of detail about the balance between THC, CBD, and one or two other items that are important to the functioning of the brain, and especially to relief of stress and worry. And one of the most interesting things, it shows a bit the way science works, because there's a set of chemicals that basically provide this kind of relaxing protection. And at one stage, they discovered that schizophrenics had a particularly high level of these in their brains, and they figured that basically maybe the higher the level was, the worse their schizophrenia was going to be, that these chemicals, these hormones, are actually causing the problem. In fact, it turned out that it was because of other structures in the schizophrenic's brain that this was occurring, and that actually the high levels of this hormone were an attempt to keep it under control. So the initial findings of the study were in fact completely reversed in the process, and that particular link is very interesting on that subject. So we can see that it doesn't cause any harm. We can see that it doesn't cause violence. We can see that it has many uses that are being now put forward as time goes by. We might wonder how widespread is its use, you know, because we've obviously got no way of really keeping track of that, because it's illegal and people aren't likely to answer your questions honestly. But we do know that to a great extent, everyone who's anyone might well have used marijuana in their past. Most of the presidential candidates nowadays admit to using it. I suspect largely because they understand entirely the risks of not admitting it and then being found out down the line. But we know doctors, lawyers, judges, policemen, many other individuals who are otherwise deemed to be pillars of society are in fact the occasional users of cannabis. And everyone needs a supplier. I want to include now just a short link. This is I don't think I've got a link for this, but it's just a short bit from The Independent about a doctor who was accused of drug offences. She told a court yesterday, this is from, it's one of those foreign dates. I've got no idea what that says. Possibly, no, can't work out the date, so it could be some time ago. But she was accused of having bought cannabis from dealers for her sick daughter. Dr. Anne Biazanek, 65, said her daughter Lucy had an intractable illness for 13 years. No medicine worked, but cannabis made Lucy feel life was bearable and eased her pain. Dr. Biazanek told Liverpool Crown Court that she took responsibility for getting the drug because Lucy needed it, but could not risk buying it herself because she was on bail. She says, I became a criminal because my conscience said that it would be wrong for me to continue to obstruct her. I was following a higher moral law. Lucy, 33, was arrested while living in Scotland, and a bail condition was to be of good behaviour and return to her mother's Wirral home. Dr. Biazanek, a locum general practitioner and homeopath, said, asked whether she bought the cannabis from dealers in pubs, houses or on street corners, Dr. Biazanek replied, wherever I could find them. So she definitely had to go to places where she wouldn't have gone if it had been a little bit easier to get what is fundamentally something to ease human pain and suffering. The court heard that police officers raided her home in February this year and found almost 2 grams of the drug in Dr. Biazanek's handbag. Dr. Biazanek of Wallasey Wirral denies 5 charges involving supplying, attempting to supply and possessing cannabis. The case continues on Monday. We haven't got a continuation of the case, but I gather through conversation that she was freed on that one. And the judge, I gather, asked her if, having been through all that she'd been through, she'd go through it again, and she said that she would, which was given a nod and a wink by the judge, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a strange situation. It's back to the medicine again, isn't it? We've got people using it as a medicine and getting done for it. Well, you've got these companies like GW Pharmaceutical, these pharmaceutical agents that are making cannabis medicine. The whole claim is that there's no medicinal value. So what they're doing is creating this medicine, basically putting a patent on it so that they can create it with a patent so that nobody else can use that system of creating it and then selling it off as a medicine. But so they're making money off it. But when someone at home wants to use it, and they're growing maybe a plant for themselves so that they can get medicinal benefits the same way as they would out of the GW Pharmaceutical Sativex, well, they're, like you just said now, they're getting the doors busted and they're getting criminalised and put in jail for it. Yeah. So it's like one rule for the public and one rule for the pharmaceutical companies. So,
of course, one of the things that's really important to remember in all of this is that we are not talking about criminal law. We're talking about, once again, legislative law, about acts of parliament which are only given the force of law with our consent. There's for a whole manner of stuff in the podcasts on TNS Radio to do with subject matter jurisdiction. There's many podcasts on, I know, on my own podcast page, which can be got to from TNS, that deal with this precise subject, because technically speaking, until we admit that it's weed, or until we admit that it's cannabis, it's not cannabis. It's clearly not that simple, but it nonetheless is a fact, and there are some defences that can be sort of spread right from the door, as it were, to try and ensure that trouble doesn't get too far. Nonetheless, it's quite clear from all the stuff we've heard so far that governments, certainly in the West, are pretty determined to clamp down on your dope fiend. Before, I'm going to play another tune now. I'm going to play Henry by the New Riders of the Purple Sage, a nice little ballad about a guy who's going down to Acapulco to score himself 20 golden keys. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Union, which was the subject of the vid that I watched in British Columbia. And it's a pretty amazing story of how it is that British Columbia has become one of the primary suppliers of high-grade cannabis to the United States of America and Canada. And it is quite mind-boggling what it is that the people over there have managed to set up for themselves, and well worth a bit of investigation, I think. I'm just trying to get my broadcaster back up. So you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show live on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com, and tonight we're talking cannabis with Ian of the Gwynedd Cannabis Club. Before we go into what Ian's been doing with the government here in Wales and some of the stuff that our government's got to say on this subject, I'd like to have a little bit of a look at the Union in British Columbia, which is the union after which the movie Union, the business behind Getting High, was made. And one of the questions the documentary poses at the beginning is, how does such a massive underground market survive whilst remaining illegal? And the answer really is quite incredible. It's one of the great reasons for watching the vid in the first place, because you've got to imagine the levels of community trust and cooperation that are going on here, despite the fact that what's going on is allegedly unlawful or illegal. It's a whole new way of doing things, I reckon. So basically, British Columbia is now a massive supplier of weed to Canada and to the United States of America, and it's suspected that it's got more grow operations per domicile than anywhere else in the world. And it's estimated that there might be as maybe as 1 in 100. That means that 1 in 100 dwellings is out there running lights and growing a bit of this and that. And this means that a small town in that neck of the woods might house 17,000 domestic operations. 17,000. It's so popular there that British Columbia even has a marijuana party on the political roll. And the basic deal is that there's a homeowner who has nothing else to do with the deal apart from the fact that he supplies a building. And he deals with a contractor who takes something like 50-50 on the cut. He's described as a 50-50 contractor. He's also the fall guy. So if the operation cops for it, he's the guy that takes the blame. Also, at this level of the organisation, there are clippers, people who tidy up the product for sale, and they get paid 20 Canadian dollars an hour. At this stage in the process, the product is worth $1,800 a pound. So that's the local price in British Columbia, apparently, and the price at which it gets exported. This process, the process of actually supply, of getting the house itself, getting it ready, getting it installed, and suitable to do the job, is facilitated by a number of collusive traders, as I've heard them called in the past. And these include an incredible variety of people, mortgage brokers, bankers, bank tellers. They're important because it can be quite difficult to move large quantities of cash around in the United States nowadays, or indeed in the Western world generally. If it's over $3,000, we're told, in the States, then the teller, if he's suspicious, can inform authorities. It's only at $10,000 that there is a legal obligation, such as that obligation is, to report to authorities that cash has turned up. So if you've got yourself a cooperative teller, it's simply a matter of, oh, you've sold your motorcycle, great, you sold your boat, well done, and you can keep putting in $9,999, and away you go. So bank tellers, carpenters, electricians, hardware stores, grow shops, seed sellers, clone growers, realtors, builders, a whole string of people. And remember, they've managed to get perhaps 1 in 100 domiciles with this thing running. So there's a lot of people cooperating with each other, and every single one of them is taking a risk. Every single one of them is having to trust everybody else. There's also plenty of other benefit being taken from the operation, of course. There are local bars, restaurants, clothing stores, retailers of cars and boats, and all of that stuff will also be benefiting from this kind of activity, basically untaxed activity, unless, of course, you choose to put on your marijuana tax as you're to stamp as you're turning things out. There's also lawyers and law firms who counsel on the legitimization of cash and set up and incorporate companies and holding companies to launder money. And those people also offer legal advice to keep busted growers out of jail. And, of course, other beneficiaries include the law enforcement community, because they get to confiscate the money, chattels and properties of anybody who's busted. Sounds like there's got to be a reasonable board game that could be made out of this somewhere, I reckon. In fact, I think the Furry Freak Brothers did. They did, a long time ago. They gave away a game called It's a Raid. I remember that. If the... do you want to...
Yeah, I was just going to mention that also in Europe, Nick, what they've got is they've got private social cannabis clubs set up around Europe now. Like in Spain, for instance, you've got cannabis clubs which have members, and what they're doing is they're growing it, producing it, supplying it all through the club. So what you do is you can become a member, you get vetted to make sure that you're old enough and that there's no problems, and then you pay for your cannabis, but you pay less because nobody's making a profit. But there is a little profit just to cover, like, the people that are growing, to cover the costs of growing, to cover maybe someone to cut it, and to cover maybe the when it's getting sold as well, wages for someone to get sold. So this actually is what the UK cannabis club scene, this is where we want to be. But obviously with the laws we've got in this country, we're struggling to get to there, because in Spain, they've decriminalised cannabis, so you're not going to get done for having cannabis on you. So then it opens the market up then so that it can be regulated properly. Also in Portugal, they've got a system of decriminalisation where no one gets criminalised for drugs. And they've got a good education system in place there as well, so that when people are seeing, when people are seeing in practice what the drugs do to you, and because it's decriminalised, people can actually see what's happening. And say a heroin user maybe would, he would go to somewhere where that is set up to get his needles, and he would take it there. So people then get to see, and there's what also that does is it causes stigmatisation, because who as a heavy drug user wants to go to a set up place where you're going to get your needles and get, so sort of making people aware of what's going on. And then through that, in Portugal, what they've done is they've brought the amount of people that use heroin down by a good majority. And that's just through education and decriminalisation. So you're not criminalising people for doing it, you're helping people that are on it, because obviously they've got an addiction problem. It's not something to be criminalised, it's something that should be helped. So,
yeah, that's a very good point. I'd say about the legalization of cannabis in Spain, as far as I can gather, there's, because of Google and everything, there's every chance that the local gendarmes, if they can see it, are going to come down and have it away. It just disappears overnight. So the actual kind of enforcement has been decriminalized as well. There's a strange kind of balance going there.
Yeah. Also, from what I've read, because I've done a bit of research into the Spanish club system, they've actually got the police linked up through the phone lines and through the internet to these cannabis grows, so that if anyone does try and break in, it actually goes through to the police, and the police are there straight away.
Oh, that is absolutely fantastic, because it sounds one way or the other like the police are being encouraged there to do their job properly, as it were. I think personally that's really exciting. I was excited by the British Columbia story, because of the levels of community and cooperation that I saw going on there.
Yeah, well, since I've joined this UK cannabis club scene and the Welsh cannabis club scene, the people I'm meeting, they're all the same. You know, everyone wants to help everyone. It's not a case of everyone's fighting everyone. It's a case of, you know, what you're doing, we'll try and push on from that, and then someone else comes along and says, right, we'll try and push on from that. So it's a good, the cannabis community is a good, helpful community. Everyone's there to help each other, and and that's the only way we're going to get somewhere in the cannabis community, is through helping each other, because obviously if we all fight each other, we're not going to get anywhere.
It's the only way we're going to get anywhere with anything, I reckon. I think the other important point you made there was about the fact that this is, you mentioned Spain and Portugal. Obviously, there's a degree of liberalisation in Holland as well, and I gather in Belgium. I'm not sure. Czech Republic. Yeah. Now, one of the things that the Sativex link that we put in the chat box earlier on points out towards the end of the article is that if the legislation in the UK were to change, then it could be unrolled over Europe. So this would be effectively the legalisation or decriminalisation, however they choose to do it, of the actual cannabis mix and the Sativex. And it's definitely my impression from that particular article that the thing that is stopping that from happening is legislative inactivity in the UK. And once again, because it comes up so often, I'm forced to look at it and think, well, it does seem to me that the Crown in England, the Crown Corporation, is what's standing in the way of all of this. When things happen in the UK, once they've happened here, they happen elsewhere. So that's, but I really love the idea that people are getting together and cooperating. And that's the way gardeners do work. All gardeners, it's one of the exclusive places where whenever two gardeners come together, both gardeners learn something. And in my experience, really nothing's held back. You know, the gardening is one of the prime exemplars, and I'm really pleased to see that this specialised form of gardening is living up to the mark, as it were.
Yeah, Uruguay also, better mention them, because from what I believe, the president in Uruguay has stated that what they want to do is actually take control of the cannabis market, because in Uruguay cannabis is grown, and they've fought wars against the, you know, drug wars for decades now, and they're obviously not winning. So what the government have decided to do there, what they're in the process of putting through, is actually taking the cannabis production and taking the whole sort of job on themselves, and going to be selling it out with tax. By doing that, what they hope that they're going to do is take cannabis out of the harder drug market, so that what they're doing is separating cannabis as a sort of benevolent, sort of quite safe drug, and they're separating it from stuff like crack and heroin, opium, the stuff that other stuff that they've got growing in Uruguay. So if they can sell that and make a profit off it, then the average guy that uses cannabis, when he goes to his dealer, he's not going to be offered heroin or crack, because the government are not going to offer him heroin or crack. You know, they're just going to offer him the cannabis. So there's no gateway there then. It's control, and you're going to get your cannabis, and that's the only thing you're getting.
We might suspect that there would be problems with a national government taking over the control of such things, because it once again is likely to leave your lonely grower in the same position as he was before, but just being hammered by somebody else, or actually being hammered by government through tax and rates and all the so-called legitimate business taxes, instead of just through fines and penalties, which are also legitimate business taxes.
Yeah, I agree with that. They're probably going to tax it and make a fortune off it, actually, yeah. But that's why in this country we want the cannabis. That's why we're setting the cannabis club scene up early, so that if something does happen on the UK cannabis scene, decriminalisation or anything like that, then we've got a system in place that can regulate the sale and production of cannabis and make sure that it doesn't go out to any youngsters. And, you know, you're not going to get contaminated cannabis by getting it through a club either, because it's going to be grown, it's going to be tested, it's going to be good quality. So you're not going to have it sort of sprayed with contamination, sand or paint in some cases, glass even. So it's been found, yeah. And this is what prohibition causes in a way, because people are growing, gangs get involved then, and they grow it in large amounts, and they're growing it to sell it. So they spray it and they put stuff in it while it's growing, so that they add more weight to it. So through a cannabis club system, you're taking the price down, because it's not being taxed, and it's going to be priced at a rate that sort of corresponds with what you're getting, really. So if you're getting a low grade, you pay a low grade price. If you get a medium or a high grade, you're paying for what you're getting. And it's not contaminated.
It also has to be said that the relative levels of THC, which is the less useful component, and CBD, which is the more useful component, is highly reliant on the way the plant is grown, and specifically when it is cropped. And that's another advantage you would get through this system, is because these principles are understood.
Yeah, because contaminated weed could also mean sort of being cut down early. So say you had a strain that was supposed to go for 9 weeks, and obviously, if people, gangs, want to make money out of it, they would take it down at 7 weeks instead of the nine. And what they're doing by doing that is there's going to be more of a psychoactive ingredient in it, which is not the best. And because it's been taken down early, and because it's not probably been dried properly, it's going to be wet, damp. The THC and the CBD is not going to be fully formed. So I would call that contaminated weed.
And the same thing goes, I gather, if you harvest it too late as well, that tends to increase the woozy element of it, and perhaps the demotivating factor. So as well as poor practice in terms of additional stuff, there is also the question of horticultural know-how, of which there is a vast, vast wealth available now. And it's great to think of it all coming together, with people that are talking to each other and cooperating. To return to, just briefly, to the British Columbian Union, which goes beyond the aims of the Cannabis Club, because I suspect, because it's been so successful, they're managing to grow so much of the stuff that they're far outstripping their domestic requirements, which means that every now and then they need this weird creature called a weed broker, which is somebody who finds somebody who can have your weed off you. And they take on a border jumper. So the idea is to move the stuff south out of Canada into America. And by the time it reaches the border, or leaves the border jumper, it's worth $3,000 a pound. So it's gone from $1,800 to $3,000 in that little move. As the weed moves further south, its value rises to maybe $6,000 a pound. And it can be more where penalties are particularly stiff. And from there, from South America, from kind of the southern states of America, Central America, South America, some weed is paid for in cocaine, which is then run back into Canada. So you can start seeing how the amount of money that's being generated is going way beyond the amount of money that's actually earned, as we always know, on the ground by the people who are doing the work. And I would guess that the intention of the Cannabis Club is to keep it one way or the other closer to the $1,800 and away from the $6,000. I mean, my own experience is that basically street prices can be more or less halved by that kind of activity.
Yeah, well, the problem we've got in Britain at the moment is the prices as well. Yeah, for some reason, the prices have just gone through the roof, and most of the time you're not even getting what you're paying for. So say, I think the going rate, I would think in the whole of the UK is something around £10 a gram. So you pay £10 for a gram, but if you weighed it, you'd probably find out that sometimes it's 0.4, 0.6, 0.6, and sometimes wet. So, and it's probably been taken down early. So it's not good, and you're paying a fortune for it. So that's what prohibition causes again. I mean, if you were in Spain, you could get a good quality for a lower price. If you were in Holland, you could get a good quality for a lower price. Even in America now, in some states where they've decriminalized it, it's basically legal to go out and buy it. And I can see now in America, probably you're going to get the cannabis club scene starting up there, so that there's nobody's making a profit out of it, because from what's being said on the internet and the news channels in America, it seems that big companies, big tobacco and alcohol companies, are trying to get in on the trade now that it's legal. So they obviously know there's a lot of money there. But even the fact that it's legal in some states in America, in Mexico, just over the border, it's still illegal, and they've got a massive, massive problem of drugs and criminality associated with drugs there. So it doesn't make sense, and I'm sure the Mexican president has actually said it, he said it on a radio station, that it's not making much sense now that Mexico are stopping and busting big drugs worth of cannabis, while in some states of America they're selling it to any sort of Joe Blogs. So it just doesn't make sense that in one country over the border now they're criminalizing people, and just over the border in America you can go and buy it from a shop.
I'd suggest that the two problems are intimately linked, that the actual border between Mexico and USA has been seriously thinned, and that basically the two things are cooperative. The market's on one side of the border, the production units on the other side of the border. That's a very easy way of taking it from $1,800 to $6,000 a pound. You know, it's economic forces operating there. We know that the massive amount of the so-called Mexican drug problem comes directly from the fact that it has a massive market just north of a very porous border. So it's pretty clear, certainly from the British Columbian example and also from various other bits of evidence, that prohibition has not in any way reduced either demand or supply. In fact, it has probably rather increased both, because if you increase the demand, you will increase the supply. And if the supply is increasing as a result of increased demand, under standard economic theory, of course, which is more or less totally invalid, then prices will rise accordingly. It inflates prices, therefore, while supply and demand grow, and this provides a steady income for organised crime. That, of course, is a very difficult phrase, because by definition, anybody who's organised themselves to do this has become organised crime. But for many years, I've been claiming that the only truly free trade economy is the black economy, basically. And it does work. Like Ian's suggesting, when you get people working together in trust, which as regular listeners will know is something I'm doing a lot more of, trying to avoid the gaming tokens and working for other things, then the value of your labour goes up. The price of things tends to go down, and maybe as much as half, like I say. So it's worth organising. It's worth getting our wits together and talking to each other, because it makes our life cheaper and easier. It really does. I know that people think that community is not possible and that it doesn't work, but on that sort of level, it is really something towards which we could be driving. And I'm certainly going to, you know, I congratulate you, Ian, and everybody else who's sticking their heads over the parapet and making a bit of a fist of this. Of course, also under the current system in British Columbia, youngsters are attracted to grow by the availability of easy money. So not only are they attracted to buy it by the fact that, you know, it's easier to get hold of than alcohol and tobacco, the education system and the economic state of the place leaves people in no position necessarily to get a job which is actually going to pay for the demands that are being put upon them by the state. And it is absolutely obvious that even if they were operating on their own, it would be easier for them to get money this way. It's obviously a lot more easy if people are cooperating and the rest to give a degree of protection, and if accountability is, you know, assigned. So that's the basic situation there. I was pretty encouraged by that, and I think it's really brilliant that I found out about that at the same time as the cannabis clubs, because it seems, like I say, it looks to me like a little flower flowering in what's been a lifetime of desert. As far as I'm concerned, it's always been a bit of a struggle, unless you happen to be at the Stonehenge Free Festival when everything was available. Well, anything that was worth having, anyway. So what about the current situation in this country? You sent me a link to something David Cameron had to say on the subject. By the time I got there, the page was not to be found, although that might have been my own distinct dislike of reading or listening to anything this particular oik has got to say. So, over to you, Ian.
Well, like you said, the demand for cannabis has gone up, and it's going up in the UK, it's going up worldwide. That's why you've got groups starting up everywhere. That's why you've got people standing up against governments in America, and, you know, this is what's happening. But for some reason, David Cameron thinks that everything's okay and everything's working. So, there has actually been a report just recently, and Keith Vaz, who's the Commons Home Affairs Select Committee chairman, he told a BBC Radio 4 Today programme that a royal commission to look at every aspect of drug policy was needed for the UK, because, like what he said we're in a do or die situation. He said it's now or never. He says we're at the stage now where we have to do something about drugs or cannabis. What they recommended was a royal commission, and they even put in the report that it was too big and sensitive an issue for the Conservative, or for any political party, including David Cameron's Conservatives, to deal with, because it is too big and sensitive an issue for them to deal with, because they're not the scientists. They are politicians that have been elected.
At the same time, they're well ignored Professor Nutt.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, they don't like it when evidence suggests otherwise, do they? So the MPs that also did this report, they also suggested that the British government should fund a detailed research project monitoring the recent legislation of marijuana in US states, Washington and Colorado, and the proposed state monopoly of cannabis production in Uruguay, like we were talking about earlier. So the committee actually visited all these places and Portugal. They visited these places so that they could make this report, and they came back and basically said, yeah, okay, now's the time, we're going to have to re-look at this. Yeah. So they set the report out, needs to be looked at. Everything was rosy, we thought, as the UK cannabis clubs and the cannabis club scene, we thought, right, we might get somewhere with this now. Yeah. And then the next day, David Cameron, there was reports coming out everywhere. David Cameron has ruled out a royal commission to consider the decriminalisation and legalisation of drugs on the grounds that the government's current approach is working perfectly. That was exactly the statement he said. So, I mean, we're obviously on the...
Now you see exactly why I don't like listening to anything the bloke's got to say.
Yeah, so it seems David Cameron is sort of has one rule for everyone, and that's his rule. So he's not, even though his own MPs, which was a cross party of MPs as well, it was the Liberal Democrats, it was Labour, it was Conservatives, and in fact, if I'm correct, David Cameron was actually on the committee that decided on drugs 7 years earlier, and he was part of the committee that advised the same, that the drugs need to be re-looked at. So it was strange that he sort of dismissed it within a couple of hours of seeing it. And the next day, David Cameron actually was quoted as saying that he hadn't read the report. So this is thousands of pounds of public money spent on a report that he didn't even bother to read before declining to even look into it. And then Nick Clegg, who was a Liberal Democrat, so you'd think he'd be there to stand up for the drugs laws. He wasn't heard from for about 2-3 days after this. And then he came out eventually saying that Nick Clegg said that the current policy was not working and has accused politicians of a conspiracy of silence regarding drugs. So he was basically saying that, hey, you know, now we need to talk about it now because it's got to the stage where if we're going to, well, this is what I'm thinking, if we carry on giving misinformation out, we're going to get hung and dried probably in the next few years with the whole of Europe, America, South America, all deregulizing, decriminalizing. It's just going to look stupid on the UK. So he also said that Cameron should have the courage to look at issues such as decriminalization or legalization of drugs. And Clegg recommended that a royal commission to look at it. So we're supposed to have the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives share in power, but they've obviously got different views on this, and Cameron doesn't seem to be wanting to sort of budge on it either. It's no, and Nick Clegg is entitled to his opinion, and that's it. That was his view. So Nick Clegg even said, if you were waging any other war where you have 2,000 fatalities a year, your enemies are making billions in profits, constantly throwing new weapons at you and targeting young people, you'd have to say that you were losing and it's time to do something different.
Which is a far different thing from saying everything's working perfectly well, and that is a classic example of what happens when trust and cooperation is not occurring. Amazing. Like I say, when I went to look at those links, which I haven't actually got for you because when I went there it said that the page had gone, but given the kind of stuff we've heard over the last 2.5 hours or so, I would humbly suggest that that response from David Cameron is beyond wholly inadequate, if there is such a thing possible. Amazing. So that's the English government. Well done them. That's obviously going really well. How are you getting on with Plaid Cymru? Because of course they're in opposition, which means it's definitely in their interest to at least look like they're cooperating with you. So how are you getting on with them?
Yeah. Right. I started off going to see Elvin Llwyd, and I sat down with him, and I sort of took my papers out, started discussing cannabis with him, and he instantly went into a rant of how lethal cannabis was. So that's how we started off with the MP, and then I sort of took some papers out and stuck some scientific facts down in front of him, told him how Sativex was a cannabis extract, a cannabis whole extract. And I gave him the GW Pharmaceuticals Sativex ingredients, and I said to him, listen, this is what the side effects Sativex say there are to cannabis, and he said that they were very low. The GW Pharmaceuticals have put that the side effects of Sativex is very, very low, and with hardly any addictive qualities. And that is pure cannabis at a stronger, I think it's 50% THC.
Yeah.
So they're selling a super, super duper strong skunk on the market, and they're saying it's safe. So, after seeing that, Elvin Llwyd sort of realised, okay, maybe there is something to this, and he started changing his tune. But he was, like I say, he wasn't for the decriminalisation, although he said that he agreed that people, and that he'd seen evidence of people, getting benefits medicinally, so I couldn't see how we couldn't want to decriminalise after seeing that there was medicinal value in it. So Elvin Llwyd is also an ex lawyer or solicitor. He's it's something to do with law anyway. And after I went through the Sativex problem with him, he did agree that there was corruption. And he even said that the corporations are our puppet masters. He sat back and he said, well, the corporations, they are our puppet masters.
I suppose you had a voice recorder with you, did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. It is all recorded. I've got it down, yeah. Yeah, I've got it all, yeah, yeah. It was a very interesting conversation, actually, except for him, he was also answering his phone every 5 minutes when he was having a meeting with me. So that wasn't very good, because when you're trying to get deep into something, you know, and he just kept answering his phone and, oh, hello, and then it was sort of getting muffed up and we had to start again. But we eventually got through it all, and he agreed that he was going to bring some questions up. He has brought some questions up, but I'm not going to. There's no point in me talking about it now because we're still pushing. Because we didn't get proper answers. He asked some. He cited the main questions really, and we didn't get answered what we wanted answered.
So you're going to be approaching him with the voice recorder again?
I'm going to be going back to see him soon. Yeah, so next time he's around this area, I'll be going to see him. Right, so I've also contacted as well Leanne Wood, who is the Plaid Cymru, the Party of Wales leader. She is the Plaid Cymru. She's told me that Plaid Cymru is for the decriminalisation of cannabis. And that's what they're supporting. I've written emails to her, letters to her, and fair play. Every time she says that she's supporting what we're doing and that she understands that people are old-fashioned and still think that you know it's a dangerous drug, but we have to work with people from where they are. Because obviously I'm trying to push to get a meeting with her so that we can discuss a cannabis club and a system of regulation. Because if they're going to decriminalise cannabis, they can't just, as a party, you can't just say, oh, we want to decriminalise cannabis unless you've got something behind it that can control it. So what we're trying to do as the Welsh Cannabis Club is we're trying to, as a Gwynedd Cannabis Club as well, is we're trying to get to meet Leanne Wood and have a discussion with her about how a social cannabis club could work in Wales and how we could sort of make sure it comes back to the quality of the cannabis, making sure that it's not contaminated, making sure that youngsters don't get hold of it. So basically you're putting rules in place so that you have safe access to cannabis, not like it is now. At the moment, if you're a youngster, 14 years old, you can go to the local dealer in town and you can get cannabis from him, and he's going to ask for a £20 note. He's not going to ask for ID. So how prohibition works, does it make sense to me? Because you can't do that with cigarettes and alcohol. You can't just walk in at 14 years old and buy cigarettes and alcohol. I mean, there is ways that people get it. I'm not saying that, but you need to make it as difficult as you can. And by going to a dealer, you're not making it difficult for them. In fact, you're introducing them to harder drugs, because that's what the dealer's going to have. He's going to have a bit of something harder, which he's going to say, oh, well, if you want a bit of this, or know someone who wants this. Or, in fact, take a bit of this and try it, and if you like it, come back for more. Yeah. And that is what our government in the UK, because it's not happening in Europe now, this is what our government in the UK are pushing.
And that also encourages youngsters into crime as well, because some of them might be useful, might be able to get their fix for free.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, someone who's an addict is going to be on a drug that is addictive. So they're going to want money for an addictive drug. But cannabis, like you've seen, is the lowest addictive out of everything we've seen, even prescription drugs. So, and that's why there is no crime associated with cannabis, unless you're the government and you decide, oh, we're going to kick doors down and criminalise the people that grow it, or we're going to stop the average guy on the street, and if he's got some weed in his pocket, we're going to criminalise him.
Before we kind of wrap up with one or two conclusions, I know that we both came across Tommy Chong in our research for this show. Chong was, of course, one half of the famous comedy duo Cheech and Chong, who tried through parody to bring the absolute truth about marijuana use to young people. Now, I know that Tommy got into some trouble, which we'll go into in a minute, but I gather from you that he also found some real benefits from the cannabis.
Yeah, with Chong, what I remember a while ago, he went on air in America and said that he had cancer. He actually went on air and basically told people for the first time that he had cancer, and he said it was deliberately done so that he could tell people that he was going to treat himself with cannabis oil, Rick Simpson's cannabis oil. So he was trying to get the information out. That was his job. And then 2 months later, he went back on the telly and told everyone that he was clean, that he'd got rid of it because of the cannabis oil, Rick Simpson's cannabis oil. You can find that on YouTube as well. It was on all the American news channels, because he deliberately went and told people that he had, the news channels, that he had cannabis so that it would be big news. And then he said, right, I'm going to treat it with cannabis oil. He treated it, got better, and then went back and told everyone that he'd cured it.
Absolute excellent. Perfect technique. 10 out of 10 on that one. What comes out in the Union movie is they actually have Tommy Chong on there, together with some clips from Cheech and Chong. Didn't get them for this week. Maybe get some for next. And basically, in the year that the US government took out $25 billion to try and hunt down Osama bin Laden and $15 billion each to try and track down Saddam Hussein's sons, The video tells us that they took out $12 million to hunt down Tommy Chong. And they were endeavouring to do him for conspiring to traffic in paraphernalia, specifically in Pennsylvania, where the penalties were particularly stiff. And that was because he'd basically allowed his image, allowed a picture of his face to appear in a load of the stuff that was being produced by a company in America and distributed. It was a legitimate company paying tax. All the man had done was simply allowed his face to appear on the bong. And they charged him personally, nevertheless, for this conspiracy, even though he never shipped anything to anyone. And in the raid, they arrested 51 people, but only Chong went to jail for it. There was, he says, a 20-man SWAT team, helicopters, guns, and he said there was plenty of media. This is something we've come across before when they like to do a high-profile bust. They like to make sure that their friends in the media are there to help them. And they put him away for 9 months, and in his trial they did happen to mention that his movies were going to be affecting children forever, basically, and who knows, maybe that's why they went for him. He's still pretty chipper, though. I guess, like everybody who seems to end up behind bars, he probably learned a fair bit from it, and my guess is he was probably pretty popular back there. But there you go, a couple of tales about Tommy Chong out there having a crack all those years ago and taking a bit of a beating for it in the not-too-distant past. I'd also like to mention Mark Emery, who's a character who turns up in the Union movie, because he's a seed retailer in Canada, and you might remember that they've got clone growers and clippers. They've got all manner of little subroutines that they run over there. But this particular man, he's a seed retailer. And he got threatened with life without parole through extradition to the DEA in the United States. All this even though no one has ever gone to jail in Canada for seeds, not even for one day. And even though Mark is one of 50 registered seed sellers, he's the only one that's been charged. And he was also, like Chong, the company involved with Chong, they were paying their tax on their income and all of that. But nonetheless, he was under a lot of pressure. I'm not sure where the present state of that case is at the moment. But this man also, of course, if there is a lot now of medicinal cannabis allowed and prescribed for, and people are encouraged to grow it for themselves, and they're encouraged to go to people like Mark for their seeds. So what do you reckon happening, Ian, with people trying to... Because I think... Do you know Mark?
I used to visit a site years ago called overgrow.com. And I think from what I've, from the information I've gathered, I think that was possibly his site, or that was part of his company's site. Basically, they gave information out of, for people how to grow and tips for people, stuff like that. It's been taken down. It got taken down. There was a big DEA bust there, and they took all his stuff, took him in, and, but that was the number one growing site and, seed supplying site, in the world at the time, I believe, from what I've been told.
As far as I can see, he's still pretty active out there, so...
Yeah, I think his wife has carried on his work, actually. If you got Mark Emery, if you look it up online, I'm sure it's his wife now that's carrying on the campaign about cannabis seeds, and the fact that it's got medicinal value, and to try and change the laws, and to try and get him out of the DEA's hands.
Yea, verily, for every one of us you knock down, 1,000 will spring up in their place. So, kind of in conclusion, really, I don't think we can see any reason why it should be illegal. And we basically think that prohibition is hindering rather than helping.
Yeah, prohibition's just... it's not protecting the youth, because the youth can just go out and buy it. So prohibition's not protecting them. It's not protecting the average user, because you're going out and buying stuff that's not, doesn't weigh the proper amount, is not dry, is not being cut down early enough. So, you know, it's contaminated. So prohibition, no, I can't see. In fact, I can't think of anything that's been gained from prohibition at all.
Apart from stuff that would be to our advantage were prohibition not to be there, of course. It is entirely a disadvantageous move, I think, as far as we're concerned. it seems that marijuana does absolutely no damage at all. It's possible that under some circumstances it makes people's internal state more difficult to handle than it would have been anyway. But it's generally acknowledged that set and setting is important not only to the psychopharmaceuticals, but I mean just to real life generally.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's 100% safe because there are people. Yeah, you've got the youngsters, and you've also got pregnant women. You've also got the people that sort of have predisposed sort of mental sort of illnesses that maybe haven't come out yet. So, and there's all sorts of things that can trigger that mental illness. So, cannabis, THC, being a psychoactive ingredient, that it is possible in a tiny, tiny percentage of amount of people. It hasn't been clinically proven. That just make that point. But there is sort of evidence showing that that some people that have predispositioned mental illness, maybe it's not the ideal drug for them to be taking because THC is psychoactive. But for, I think it's something like 99.4 maybe percent of people, maybe more than that even, it's perfectly safe.
And of course the designation of something as an illness rather than an advantage is entirely done by arbitrary allocation of words by the powers that be. So might do a little bit of damage, a little bit of confusion in a very, very few places, but it certainly ain't going to do the kind of damage that psychiatric drugs do over a short period of time and even in fairly small doses, and is probably going to be reparable in time. And also, of course, it's a matter of personal responsibility rather than legislation.
Yeah, and just also with the health aspect, there is figures that show that there's more people with mental health problems connected to alcohol in this country than cannabis. So if you look at statistically, alcohol, mental health, there seems to be a big connection there. Marijuana and or cannabis and mental health, there isn't any clinical evidence of that at all. It's just hearsay at the moment.
So in the work we're doing with the cannabis clubs, what would you most like to see happen at this stage? What are your, you know, what's your top aim, and have you got kind of a couple of supporting aims that you can kind of outline so that people have got some idea of where we might go with it?
Yeah, at the moment, because everyone's sort of starting their own club up, and but we're all together, but we've sort of what's happened is we've given the sort of control for everyone to sort of push their own aspect so that we can try and cover everything instead of pushing one sort of agenda. But my agenda as the Gwynedd Cannabis Club is to try and keep pushing Plaid Cymru, because they're the Welsh party. We're a Welsh Gwynedd, you know, cannabis club. So what we're hoping to do is to get them on board with what we're doing. I mean, if we can get Plaid Cymru to say, because they've already said that they want decriminalisation of cannabis, so if we can get them to say, well, yeah, the cannabis club system does look like a safe system that could control cannabis. So if they can say that, then she's got Plaid Cymru would have a policy that they could control it by, and we could say that we were sort of supported by Plaid Cymru because they supported the cannabis club way of doing things.
I must say that I think that your aims in doing that are going to be entirely helped by the fact that you're sending them emails. Writing letters is really good. We recommend writing letters in blue ink, because that way it's a real human being that's writing, whereas if it comes in black out of a computer, it's a dead individual, effectively. So, but getting stuff in writing, putting it on file, piling it all up now rather than having to pile it up later, and getting as many voice recordings as you can, because one of the things that seems to be broadly found is that it is documentary evidence, either audio or kind of written, that really does help pin them down. It's much harder for them to wriggle out from under any obligations they might have taken on, shall we say, if that's doing so. I think that might well, that's going to work well. Presumably you're also going to be looking for, say, further intermingling and improving the communications between the various groups.
Yeah, of course, we've got meetings. We're doing admin meetings so that the admins can meet together. We're setting up sort of pages on the internet where we can all sort of get in contact and write down ideas and sort of decide what we're going to do as a nationwide club. I've got to be honest, I've only been added to this because this UK cannabis club scene has been going for a bit longer than when I've got involved, so I'm sort of newer on the scene than a lot of these guys that have been going for a while, fair play to them. Yeah, but what we would most like to see happen really is decriminalisation, because if we can get decriminalisation, then we can start the cannabis club up properly as it's meant to be around Europe. But we do have some stuff organised. We've got a march in Cardiff on May the 5th. That's going to be a million man cannabis march, and that's held in cities all over the world. It's basically trying to get everyone together so that people know what's going on.
I'll be there, folks. Beltane, cannabis march, Cardiff. I should cokey.
Yeah, so that's going to be a good one. We're hoping to get Howard Marks, Mr. Nice there. Maybe we could even get Leanne Wood from Plaid Cymru there. From what I gather, she was there last year or the year before. So these things have been going on a while. Like I say, I'm quite new on the scene, so I'm just sort of new and trying to push it a bit further. Also, we've got the Gwynedd Cannabis Club meeting, which is our area meeting, which is going to be in about 3 weeks. So if you go on the Facebook page and look for Gwynedd Cannabis Club, if you're local, then have a look at that and you get all the information off that. Anything we're doing, we put on there. Also, you've got the UK cannabis club scene, so that is basically covers everyone. We've got the Welsh cannabis club as well, if you want to have a look at that. But we're all working in cooperation with each other and hoping to work together so that we can get through to the politicians that cannabis is actually a good thing, not a bad thing.
Absolutely brilliant, and I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed chatting with you. That's been absolutely great, and perhaps at some point we can get you back on to have a look at some of the Ian tapes.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Yeah, thank you very much, Nick. Thanks a lot.
I'm sure we'll be having plenty more to do with each other, my friend. I'm sure we will. So, coming up in 10 minutes or so, the fabulous Freeman Jack. We've got about 10 minutes, like I say, left to go. An interesting link I was saying, which again I can't post, but it basically says, campaigners have urged the government to rethink drug laws in light of a widely respected independent body likening cannabis use to moderately risky gambling or junk food. Not that I'm suggesting that I think junk food can be described as moderately risky. The publication of a 6-year study from the UK Drug Policy Commission today reveals that the $3 billion spent annually, whatever that means, tackling drugs is not evidence-based, and the body calls for a wholesale review of existing laws, but as we know, a lot of our science, alas, is not evidence-based. The body, part-funded by the Home Office, was launched in April 2007 to provide objective analysis of drug policy, independent of government interference and special interest groups. Well, the best of luck with that one. We know physicists have a great deal of difficulty disentangling things, and that sounds like a disentanglement too far, but nonetheless, it's a good aim. The report, which is called A Fresh Approach to Drugs, yee-haw, examined the effects of drug policy and makes recommendations ahead of the Drug Policy Commission being wound up this autumn. So you can see they're trying to bowl a googly as well. The report recommended recategorising the possession of small amounts of drugs for personal use as a civil and not criminal offence. And they're recommending that for all drugs by the look of it, which is exactly what's happened in Portugal. It said there was an argument for amending the laws relating to growing cannabis for personal use, which might go some way to undermining the commercialisation and production. In England and Wales, 160,000 people are given cannabis warnings each year. The National Treatment Agency for Substance Abuse says 2.8 million people in England use drugs, but only 300,000 use heroin and crack cocaine, which cause the most problems. So that little bit, 300,000 out of 2.8 million are causing most of the problems, and yet most of the budget is going on the heavy side of that. The UK DPC report said there are some moderately selfish or risky behaviours that free societies accept will occur. some moderately selfish or risky behaviours that free societies accept will occur and seek to limit but not prevent entirely, such as gambling or eating junk food. Well, I'd say gambling or smoking marijuana. I mean, smoking cannabis is, I think, miles less addictive than gambling, and junk food. Well, I know, I just don't need to tell you about it, and fortunately there isn't really the time. I think we can wrap it all up by saying that cannabis causes people to think and ask questions, as should its treatment by the World Management Team. Enough said. I'd like to say thank you very much to TNSRadio.com and ScottishSovereignsOnTheLand.ning.com for making the space for this discussion to be made more available, and I'd like to thank Ian especially for coming on and giving of his time. Really appreciated it, mate. Thanks.
Yeah, also thanks very much for having us on and for letting us talk about the cannabis club scene. Thanks very much.